Okay, I want to call this meeting of the Oregon Board of Forestry to order, and first we'll do our roll call. Nils Christopherson.
Here.
Cindy Deacon Williams.
Here.
Joe Justice.
Here.
Jim Kelly.
Here.
Brenda McComb.
Here.
Mike Rose is not here. I'm Tom Imeson. We do have a quorum. I'll remind people once again that this public meeting will be live streamed all day so that it's helpful for those who have electronic devices to silence them for the duration of the meeting. I also want to note that the board will meet in closed executive session starting at 3:45 today pursuant to ORS 192-6602H. The purpose of that session will be to confer with legal counsel regarding the board's rights and duties related to current litigation or litigation likely to be filed. Representatives of the news media and designated staff shall be allowed to attend the executive session. All other members of the public are not allowed to join. We will adjourn this meeting directly after the executive session is done, so we won't come back for any further business. Also, in order to ensure that the board has the opportunity to conduct all the business on the agenda for its meetings, public comment for agency topics will be limited to no more than 30 minutes and received upon conclusion of the topic's presentation. A sign-up sheet is available for public comment on a first-come, first-served basis. So let's now proceed with the consent agenda. Is there a motion for approval of consent items A through B? Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion or questions? All those in favor, then please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And we'll now move to the state forester comments.
Morning, folks. Today is National Administrative Professionals Day, and this day provides us a welcome opportunity to recognize a remarkable professionalism and positive contribution our skilled administrative staff brings to our daily workings here at the Department of Forestry. I am fortunate to receive exceptional support from Brandy Ritter, who has continued to maintain a high level of performance of our executive support team. I want to thank team members Heidi Emk, Crystal Bader, Kristen Whitney, and Megan Ennell, and they all understand I butcher names all the time. And special thanks to Hillary Olivos-Rood, who has raised the level of board support. And finally, thanks to all of ODF's administrative staff here in Salem and throughout the district. We could not do our job without these professionals. Please help me recognize them. Thank you very much. I always like starting off on something nice.
Are you warning us?
Yeah. No, I'm all positive today. I'm going to talk about some things that are always constant with this change in our executive team. And as you've seen through previous emails, Lena Tucker has been selected to serve as the next deputy state forester. We're taking a long transition. I've had asked Travis to be here through June, and so Lena will begin her new role full-time on July 1, although she's taken up some of the duties already. Travis Medina will remain in service to the executive team throughout the end of September, providing support for the Governor's Wildfire Council and additional capacity for agency leadership through the fire season. So he'll be returning to his duties as Eastern Oregon Area Director on October 1. And I'd like to recognize Mike Shaw and the others in Eastern Oregon area who have stepped up to fill in behind Travis while he's served us in Salem. With Lena moving into the Deputy State Forester position, Kyle Abraham has been selected as the new Private Forest Division Chief. And as you know, Kyle has been serving as the Deputy Division Chief for Private Forest, and he will also begin his new role full-time on July 1, and we're excited to welcome Kyle to the executive team. And finally, Joy Krasick has joined the executive team. Joy, please stand up. As our Public Affairs Program Manager, bringing nearly 15 years of experience in public sector communication, Joy came to ODF from the Department of Revenue. We stole her from Satish. he's not happy. where she led the their communications operation. She has a master's of public policy and strategic public relations and has spent her early years of her career as a journalist and later as a non-commissioned officer in charge of Army Public Affairs Unit. She currently lives outside of Dallas with her husband and two highly energetic rescue dogs, and I'm pleased to welcome her to ODF and looking to working with her on the executive team. Thanks. And I'm going to thank Ryan Gordon. You've seen him around at the board meetings for the last 6 months or so. He has stepped up and took over as program director for public affairs and support for the board and the executive team while we recruited for the position. And he'll be returning to his private force duties on May 1st. And he's taking a well-deserved vacation now, and he has a big smile on his face. Oh, I did have one sort of thing. It's time for your board self-evaluation. It's time where we prompt the board to conduct their annual self-evaluation of performance and meeting best management practices and governance. This is also one of our key performance measures. And so Bill Herber, our Deputy Director for Administration, will follow up next week with a survey and an overview of the process. So just a reminder, that'll be coming your way. So moving on, as you know, we're in a full legislative session, and I continue to appreciate the number of ODF employees that contribute to bill analysis, drafting of testimony to prepare myself and division chiefs for appearances at committees down at the Capitol. The primary natural resource issue is debating a cap and invest policy, which will cap carbon dioxide emissions from regulated entities, including electricity generators, natural gas suppliers, transportation fuel importers, and industrial manufacturers with greater than 25 million metric tons of emissions, CO2 emissions annually. Proceeds from sale allowance would be invested in climate adaptation and mitigation practices. We submitted a white paper to the Office of Carbon Policy on potential investments in working forests. They included four broad categories: fuel reductions, urban and community forestry, ecological and riparian function, and management planning and estate planning. So specific things that could be invested in terms of mitigation. We also provided testimony. We'll be covering that late in agenda topic 4 to the Joint Committee on Carbon Reduction about forest ecosystem carbon. We have also responded to and provided testimony on bills proposing amendments to the Forest Practices Act and special assessment tax rates for forest lands. We've also provided testimony in regard to several bills restricting or outright banning the aerial application of pesticides. Earlier this month, we passed a deadline in the legislative session with only a few high-priority bills remaining alive, none of which are related to the topics I just described. I will highlight two bills that have moved on that the board heard about in March. The Committee for Family Forest Lands, Oregon Small Woodlands Association, Thousand Friends, discussed the forest dwelling allowance legislation for a second dwelling on forest lands in March to the board. That bill and House Bill 2225 relating to forest template dwellings were modified and approved by committee and passed the House, and they are now in the Senate. And I know at the board meeting, the sense there was that they were not moving forward. So there was work that was done with the committee, and amendments were drafted, and they both moved forward and passed the House. So more to see. It still has to go through the Senate. We are still waiting to hear definitive news about our budget. We have not had a second phase hearing scheduled with a Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Some of the things going on, Representative Marsh has prepared a forest fire and forest resiliency investment package for 20 positions that include 9 of our top 10 priority positions in our policy option package. The remainder of the positions are more focused on creating resilient forest and include 7 wild and urban interface foresters and additional state forest positions. The representative and stakeholders worked with us in crafting the package, and we have, but we have heard that there's also competing proposals for increased capacity. So we actually really appreciate the interest in getting us additional capacity that is currently going on in the legislature around fire and fire response, but cannot support any requests not included in the governor's budget. So we support the governor's budget. And then also at the request of the legislative fiscal office, we did resubmit information on reduction options. So still swirling around and waiting to hear more on our budget process. The Revenue Committee did hold a hearing on our harvest tax bill, which is a regular bill to set the harvest tax rates associated with our Forest Practice Administration. It was held in conjunction with House Bill 2495, which proposed a major harvest tax revision that created a wildfire suppression fund that would parallel our Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, essentially collecting money to provide the same functions as the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. However, the new fund would have to be fully exhausted before the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund could be expended. So this approach would complicate our financial tracking. We would have to administer the fund, new fund, with a ready understaffed finance program. So those both had public hearings, but there has not been a work session scheduled. My last topic is going to be the Governor's Wildfire Response Council. As you have heard, the council's tasked with reviewing Oregon's current model for wildfire prevention, preparedness, and response, analyzing whether or not the current model is sustainable, given our increasing wildfire risk. The council membership includes representation from a broad range of interest. And the council does intend to take a broad view of wildfire response, as well as impacts of public health and the economy. I'm providing direct support to the council, and Nils is serving as the ex officio member from the Board of Forestry. The council is chaired by Matt Donegan, who's developing an agenda around 3 committees: mitigation, suppression, and fire-adapted communities and recovery. And so if you're at all familiar with fire, that's the National Cohesive Wildfire Strategy. And we're looking at all aspects of that within the council. We're most heavily engaged in the Mitigation and Suppression Committee. The mitigation will focus primarily on federal lands and has a good connection with our Federal Forest Restoration Program. And Chad Davis is providing support for that committee. Joe Ferreira is a chair. The Suppression Committee is moving rapidly towards a report to the governor at the end of September. That committee had its first meeting on April 12th in Springfield. It's chaired by Ken Cummings and staffed by Travis Medema and other support. The committee will build on the Secretary of State audit, fire program review, and work on the agency initiative. So there's a lot of work already completed for that. They have developed a work plan, and they plan to address the short and long-term sustainability of our fire organization, funding structure, the wildfire insurance policy versus self-insurance, protection on Bureau of Land Management lands, approach for unprotected lands, and future partnership with the Forest Service. The Fire Adapted Communities and Recovery Committee will focus on land use planning, public health impacts, and economic recovery after fire. This committee will help develop recommendations on approaches to helping communities adapt to, survive, and recover from wildfire impacts. The council met the first time on March 18th at the World Forestry Center in Portland. Governor Kate Brown opened the meeting with reasons for creating the council and the increasing challenge of wildfire. The theme for the meeting was, prioritizing partnership and coordination emerged from remarks given by federal leaders, including the USDA Undersecretary Jim Hubbard and U.S. Forest Service Chief Vicki Christensen. And they stayed for the first half of the meeting, and then they had to leave to go to a meeting in Seaside, which we attended, where we spent 2 days with all the line officers in the Forest Service envisioning how to move forward on shared stewardship. Both myself and my counterpart, the state forester from Washington, and his staff were there. It was a really uplifting meeting, 2 days. They're really talking about a culture shift in the U.S. Forest Service, so very positive. Matt Donegan in the governor's office also showed up at the Forest Service meeting. You know, there's a nexus between the council and shared stewardship. Shared stewardship's a larger, longer-term document for agreement on how the Forest Service and the state will work together going forward. It was great to represent ODF alongside with our partners at the first council meeting. In my opening comments, I made it clear that wildfire response is the single greatest risk to our agency. The March meeting theme was, why are we here? You know, essentially defining the scope of the problem. Paul Hesselberg discussed fire ecology and the scale of the challenge of restoring fire resilient forests to the western United States. The remainder of the day was discussing environmental, social, and economic implications. Topics included ecological integrity, public safety, human health, environmental justice, electrical and water infrastructure, public finance and government program delivery, forest products, tourism, and other industries. So just kind of that reflects the breadth of the council. The second meeting was held yesterday in Salem. The theme was what we need to know. And Matt opened the meeting with council deliverables, organization, and work plan. And that was followed by an Oregon State University panel. And the panel focused on sort of decision support tools available to the council in incorporating best available science. The remainder of the meeting was spent discussing the Suppression and Mitigation Committee work plans, including deliverables and relevant background. And the meeting closed with a council discussion on priorities and trade-offs on Oregon's wildfire prone regions. Before I turn it over to Niels and Joe, who also attended, for additional comments, I will mention that Jason Miner from the governor's office wanted to be here to provide testimony in this session, and that he's hung up with Natural Resource Cabinet, which he couldn't miss. So he'll be coming later to talk about the governor's perspective on forest policy in Oregon. So any comments to add about the
committee? I mean, I think the first thing, I just want to restate what you sent out by email, which is with the Wildfire Council in front of us, and my serving on that council as liaison for the board, and Chad staffing the mitigation committee, that's really the focus of the board subcommittee on federal forests, along with providing support to you and Chad in the conversation and negotiation around the shared stewardship agreement. So that's our subcommittee agenda, and given the meeting schedule for the Wildfire Council and the committees, we're unlikely to meet otherwise. So that will be the focus for the near term for our subcommittee.
Yeah, Peter, I was just really encouraged, you know, as an Oregonian to go and see that meeting, and I think to identify as an Oregonian just the scale of the problem that they're being to educate, you know, 6 million acres of restoration that needs to take place. The understanding that this isn't going to happen overnight, you know, this has taken decades to get us to where we are. So, you know, living in Eastern Oregon for the last 20 years and hunting and coming to Eastern Oregon my whole life and seeing the changes. It's encouraging. As a forester, you know, I think about those things, and now finally we're trying to educate the public as the problem. So I'm very optimistic, very encouraged by it.
Yeah, and the breadth of the committee is what's gotten me encouraged. If the council can really come up with a strong recognition, they represent a broad range of interest, and there's a lot of tension about what the solution is. I think that's been identified up front. You know, the balance of timber monetization versus other resource monetization. You know, so it'll be an interesting discussion.
Yeah, and I like the way Matt kind of challenged council members to talk about it, to discuss it, to educate people about the scale of the problem and talk about how the solutions, how we might reach solutions. So, no, very encouraging.
Hey, any other board comments at the outside of the meeting? All right. We do have public comments. Conrad, Mary, and Nick.
Good morning. My name is Nick Cady. I'm the legal director of Cascadia Wildlands. We're here this morning, the three of us, to present a petition. It is a petition we submitted it yesterday afternoon, but it's a petition to designate resource sites for coho salmon. So for all federal and state listed species, the board has a requirement to inventory and designate resource sites and develop rules to protect these resource sites if it would conflict with forestry practices. The board is considering later today the Marble Murrelet resource site technical report that was developed by the department that they put a lot of work into. This is the same process that would go through those similar steps that the Marble Murrelet is kind of wrapped up in the technical report now. This is going to be the first time that this board has done this for an aquatic species. To date, I believe there's four or five species that the board has designated resource sites for. They've all been birds. So it might involve some kind of novel approaches that, and perhaps some adjustments to what has been done in the past. So I think largely it's catered towards birds in the past. Of course, the board is not considering this petition today. We simply wanted to introduce ourselves and field any preliminary questions that you have about the petition. Because resource sites are created by administrative rule, this is technically a rulemaking petition. And so the board has 90 days to either admit or deny this petition. To be clear, the board has a non-discretionary statutory duty to designate these resource sites for listed species. So we would recommend that you grant the petition. I am going to pass this over to Conrad and Mary to kind of discuss a little bit more of the details of the petition.
Chair Imason, members of the board, Forrester Doherty. My name is Conrad Gowell. I'm here in my capacity as the fellowship director with the Native Fish Society. I have spoken to you before, and you are probably aware we have over 4,000 members and supporters. The Native Fish Society envisions a future with abundant wild fish, healthy rivers, and thriving local communities. In our effort to cultivate a groundswell of public support necessary to revive coho across Western Oregon, we are here with 19 other organizations in the fishing and conservation categories, inviting you to consider this rulemaking petition. As a third-generation Oregonian, I'm keenly aware of the shifting baselines that have taken place around coho salmon. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story of coho in Western Oregon. But I think it takes a hard look back for all of us to really think about what coho used to symbolize to people of this region, even before it was a state. There have been several sacrifices by members of our community over the past 20 years since they were first listed. There have been severe reductions in harvest. Hatchery production has almost entirely been resolved along the Oregon coast. And there are very few barriers now in terms of hydropower dams that inhibit this species. So when the National Marine Fisheries Service finished their recovery plan just a few years ago, they leaned heavily on reforming forest practices and other impacts to fish habitat. As a reminder, these fish were first listed in 1997 in the Southern Oregon, Northern California population, in 1998 along the Oregon coast, and in 2005 in the Lower Columbia. So this is not a new story to many of you. We find it is a time that is important now to act. It kind of baffles me that we're still having to designate resource sites this many years down the line, but we find it to be very important, as Nick mentioned. I think the aquatic nature and how aquatic connections are made between forest and river habitats makes us have to redefine how resource sites are made and how we think about them. Personally, I have snorkeled many miles of the Oregon coast, and I witnessed stream buffers that have been blown down where there's not a tree standing next to streams. And I physically entered into a place where forestry has taken place and felt the temperature increases. And I can see the differences underwater when I look at the juvenile fish that are present there. So this isn't just something that people are making up or an administrative procedure. There are real consequences to what is being done on the ground. I think we need to consider our actions moving forward. Lastly, I just wanted to draw your attention to the legal requirement to consult with tribal and sovereign nations on this issue moving forward, and to be able to consider environmental justice issues. I think those are often areas that don't get the attention that they really deserve. And as we move forward, especially as we are considering what a resource site is, reaching out to those communities is going to be increasingly important. So thank you for your time, and I'll hand it over to Mary.
Good morning. My name is Mary Skurlock. I'm speaking as coordinator of the Oregon Stream Protection Coalition. You will all probably recognize that most of the members of my coalition also appear as petitioners on the document you've received. We think that this petition for rulemaking provides an opportunity for the board to take a hard look at the current water protection rules through a different and more inclusive lens than, for example, occurred under the Protecting Cold Water Rule. Looking at coho salmon provides a perspective that brings in the full suite of watershed functions and processes that create healthy salmon spawning and rearing habitat, and how forest management affects them. All of that is on the table here. As has been mentioned, this board has a duty to determine how coho resource sites will be described in rule, and we have included all three non-extinct coho salmon populations, Southern Coast, Oregon Coast, and Lower Columbia, in the petition. That decision is one part of what you're being asked to make. The other is to identify the impacts from forest operations that will be considered conflicts. And the third piece is to determine how those conflicts will be avoided. The petition before you presents informed proposals about these items, and we rely heavily on information from state and federal listing and recovery planning and related documentation. But the board, it was encouraged, as is your duty, to consider all best available science relevant to this question to ensure that you are making an informed decision. While this process has not been used for aquatic species, it is not the first time that this board has considered the impacts of forest practices on coho salmon. So I'm going to recognize that because I was involved in that effort. It's been over 20 years, though, since the Forest Practices Advisory Committee was assembled to consider water protection. And that was in a different construct of a collaborative committee with, frankly, a fairly unclear mandate. Some limited progress was made as a result, but very limited. And I think at this time, it is important to take a fresh look in the context of a resource site protection request and the considerable amount of new science relevant to watershed processes that has come to light, and very importantly, renewed and different expectations for the weather patterns that we're going to be facing under climate change. So we hope that this is taken as a constructive frame of an important and very real problem that will be additive to the efforts already being undertaken in a more narrow effectiveness parameter by parameter type of construct, and bring the focus up to the full range of Oregon surviving coho salmon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Any questions? Thanks. Yes.
What's the next step? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Peter's got a
comment.
I'll talk about that. We actually are currently analyzing the petition, which I think we got, I first saw it 4 o'clock yesterday. So I won't say I've done any detailed, but it does, as they say, formally petition the board under ORS 527.710.3 to collect and analyze the best available information on coastal Oregon coast coho salmon, conduct a resource site inventory and identify resource sites as suggested, and adopt the above suggested rules to protect resource sites. And so this is very much like the, for those that were here during the Marble Murrelet petition, they are correct. The board within 90 days must consider the petition and make a decision whether to deny the petition or initiate rulemaking. If the board initiates rulemaking, it is not bound by the proposed language in the petition, but can come up with its own language and own approach. If the board denies a petition, it must do so in writing. The board has broad discretion on this, and staff may make recommendations, but ultimately it's the board's responsibility to respond. So as what we would do is continue to analyze the petition and evaluate potential board responses. The department will, analysis will identify pros and cons of alternatives and their consequences. So we would bring, you know, a staff report to you within 90 days, you know, and help discuss what your alternatives are. But it's the board's decision whether to initiate rulemaking.
So it'll be back before us within that 90-day period, along with public input and comment. And so
June or July meeting.
Correct.
Yes. Any other?
Did that get your question?
Thanks.
Thank you. We also have some future natural resource leaders here this morning who would like to address the board. Is that right?
Yes. I need to talk to the microphone.
Yeah, because we are the
and formally identify you need to formally identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Yeah. I'm Kirk Hutchinson from the Future Natural Resource Leaders of Oregon, the Executive Director. Good morning, and thank you, Chairman Imeson and the board, for allowing us to speak today. My name is Kirk Hutchinson, and I am the Executive Director of the Future Natural Resource Leaders of Oregon, known as the FNRL, and I have with me some students and others who would like to speak to you about our organization and the effect that CTE education has on them, and I would like them to come up and give their name and their introductions.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is John. I'm a senior, and I go through the Sabin-Schellenberg Technical Skills Center through their forestry program.
Could you speak closer to the mic? Pull the mic up a little bit towards you. Thank you.
My name is John. I go to the Sabin-Schellenberg Technical Skills Center. I'm a senior, and I attend their forestry program, and it's really taught me like what I'm going to do with my life. It's given me passion towards forestry, and I'm really thankful for the opportunity to attend this program and attend this meeting.
Thank you.
I'm Grant Clemenhagen from the Sabin-Schellenberg Skills Center. I'm a junior, and this is my second year in the program. I love the program. It's taught me about careers in forestry, natural resources, and it's kind of given me options about what I want to do for a job when I get older.
Hi, everybody. My name is Patrick Brewer. I'm an alumni of Sabin Schellenberg Technical Center for Forestry. I'm in my second year of college, currently enrolled in Mount Hood Community College, Portland Community College, and Clackamas Community College. And I am going to school next year at Oregon State for forest restoration and fire. And I really just would like to say how much this program has given me the opportunity to just kind of figure out what I would like to do with my life, because before, without this program, I had no clue, as many high school students. And also through this program, I was able to get involved with wildland firefighting, which is really where my passion lies, because through that program, I'm able actually to work with Oregon Department of Forestry during the summer, which I am extremely grateful for.
Our whole spiel right now, or just
no, just no. So, good morning. My name is Ryan Froke. I'm a graduate of Clackamas County High School, currently finishing my transfer degree from Lynn Benton to Oregon State, pursuing degrees in forest engineering and construction engineering management. I guess we'll just leave it at that for now.
Hello. As I said, I'm Kirk Hutchinson. I work with these students and others to provide experiences above and beyond the normal classroom. So career technical education is what in the old days was something called vocational education, and now we call it career technical education. The Oregon State Department of Education approves high schools to have programs in career technical education. Our state specialist in agricultural and natural resources is Reynold Gardner at the State Department of Education. Once Reynold approves a teacher and a program at a local high school, they are required to have a career technical student organization, and that is what the FNRL is. Future Natural Resource Leaders of Oregon is the student organization for programs that have a CTE program. There's other CTE programs like FFA, FBLA, HOSA, different ones depending on what you're doing. So FFA is for agriculture, HOSA is for healthcare. FNRL is for forestry and natural resources. It started 2 years ago with, 3 years ago, with Reynold and our state advisor who is here with us, Peter Metzka, over there. Peter works through OSU and the Clackamas Extension Office, and he's the state advisor. He, Reynold, and a group of teachers started this organization so that forestry and natural resources could be recognized as a viable option for students in a career pathway in high school education. FNRL, as I said, provides experiences above and beyond what students get in the classroom, and it is a proven educational model that students that participate in career technical education graduate from high school at a higher rate. They have better success in college, and they do better in lifelong learning and skills. And so we're very happy that this program was started and that we have the opportunity to give kids these experiences in forestry and natural resources. We have a number of activities that we do with our students, both on a local and a state level. The state level activities include a fire school where kids go out and learn how to fight wildland firefighting. We just did that a couple weeks ago. And the Oregon Department of Forestry Sweet Home Division puts on that fire school for us, along with many other volunteers. We have our state convention, which is coming up this Friday and Saturday. We have an Envirothon where students learn about all kinds of scientific and technical environmental activities. And then each school has local CDEs that they put on for a variety of things. We have leadership activities, we have technical activities, and we have skills activities. So I'll turn it over to Ryan to say any comments he might have.
Yeah, I got a little bit written here. So as I said, my name is Ryan Froke. I attended Plaska High School. And there I took 2 years of forestry and a year of wood production. So I'd just like to take a minute to speak to the value of these programs and how these programs have continued to positively impact not only my life, but the lives of hundreds of current and past FNRL students across the state of Oregon. So in my 2 years of forestry, I learned a lot of things, how to splice an eye in a cable, to map reading and timber cruising. Competed in a lot of physical events that, you know, those were fun, but, you know, the ones that really started to pique my interest in a forestry career were things like written expression and prepared speech, both of which challenge students to research and educate themselves on, you know, various natural resource topics like sustainable harvesting and fuel reductions programs. So it opened my eyes to a whole new career path that not yet, or I had not and otherwise wouldn't have considered. Opened doors to various scholarship opportunities and led to the development of many professional relationships. So my senior year, we received a career technical education revitalization grant from ODE. And with part of that grant, we invested in a circular sawmill. And so with that mill, we were actually able to produce enough lumber to support both the school's middle school and high school wood shop and construction classes. Due to limited funding, those programs would have been canceled because I couldn't, you know, provide materials for that. We were with the help from a member of the head sawyer from Simpson Lumber Mill there in Class 9. He came out and taught us all the safe practices and running the saw and you know, the techniques to minimize waste, maximize productivity, and it's also benefited the school through the construction classes use that wood to then go out and you know, build sheds for people and like do fundraisers, like raffle off a shed or whatever, and you know, sort of giving a return on the investment back into the school's career technical education program there. And personally, it has helped me. So since graduating, I still coach and help out with the competitive team there. So I've been able to use a lot of the cedar one by that we mill up there, building like Adirondack style patio furniture, things like that. Is largely paid. It's paid for a pretty good chunk of my schooling there, doing that in the summer. And as I said, I'm in the pursuit of a forest engineering degree. FNRL provides a unique and exciting opportunity for kids to become involved in a team dynamic while learning both practical skills and those specific to degrees in forestry. Such skills have led countless kids into careers in the logging and milling industries directly out of high school and provided many more with a foundation of knowledge integral to the success of those seeking secondary education in forestry. I can say for myself and many others confidently that if it were not for FNRL, we would not be where we are today. Thank you.
Good. Do you have any questions?
We all appreciate coming here today. I'm really wish you knowledge.
All right. Thank you. FNRL makes a positive difference in the lives of members by developing their potential for premier leadership, personal growth, and career success through a natural resource education. And we thank you very much.
We have two others appearing at this point, Chandra Ferrari and Clatsop County Commissioner Catherine Sutherland. Oh, okay, sure.
Whoa. I don't have anyone joining me.
You're on.
Good. Thank you for allowing me to go earlier in the agenda today. I have to return to Clatsop County for a budget meeting. I'm just here to give you brief comments. I am would if I were here longer, I would be talking about the Habitat Conservation Plan. I just want to once again confirm our desire to have a Habitat Conservation Plan. I'm a little disappointed that we have to delay it a year. I mean, it's been extended a year, but I am going to trust in the process. And what I would like to also say is that I appreciate the diversity of comments that we're getting here today, from the environmental organizations to the young people that are looking to a career in forestry. And that's the crux of what you all are facing, the wide range. Mr. Doherty talked about all the different topics that you're talking about and under this umbrella of forest management. But I think that there's also a larger truth that we get from knowing, I just want to encourage you to listen to the scientists that have spent a lifetime studying the different processes that are involved in the forests and the animals. I mean, if you look at the marbled murrelet, what a wonder, what a history that is. An ocean bird that lives its life in the ocean and comes back to the coastal forest to nest and regenerate. Are we going to be able to count all of them? No, but do I believe that they're there? Yes. They're almost like a symbol of faith. And I'm asking you to, I want to encourage the diversity in thought. I believe the timber industry and the traditional jobs that have kept Oregon what it is, those voices are very well represented. But let's think about the creatures and the values that don't have a voice, but are true all the same. So I need to stop. Anyways, thank you for letting me talk.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.